The Movie Morgue podcast is made possible through the support of our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you'd like to learn more about how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/jessicaonmain. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it all. Way to go, Jess.
Ow. Sneezy.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. Just, ah!
It sounded like you injured yourself because you sneezed so hard.
I was trying to hold it in. Guys, gals, and NB pals, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess Whitmore.
And I am your co-host and producer, Annie.
Well done. You remembered.
I get claps.
I know. And today we are going to be covering the 2006 Mamoru Hosoda film, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time. Yay, anime!
Yeah. Woo. I was excited to do another anime movie. This has been great.
Yeah, no. So, a little bit of context for this one. This is one of the first, like, non-serialized, non-like pulpy anime films I ever saw. I saw this back at anime club in college in probably about 2008, 2009, somewhere around there. And so it's been a decade since I've seen this film, and I always remembered it very fondly, and I've since then followed most of what Mamoru Hosoda has done, and he's one of my favorite directors. So yeah, I'm really excited to get to this one. What about you, Annie? Any context around this?
The only context that I had was that you kept mentioning that we should watch this movie. And I had no idea who Mamoru Hosoda was prior to seeing this movie. So I was kind of like, okay, let's do it. And that's one of the great things about the podcast is I get to see a lot of stuff that I've just never seen before. And this was a freaking treat.
Wonderful. For those of you curious, by the way, this was really nice because we actually got to sit in, well, not together, obviously. We're still on opposite sides of the country. World, globe. Even. God, fuck me. But we managed to sit down, you know, over Zoom or whatever and just watch it together, and also with my fiance, and it was a lovely time.
Yeah, it was super lovely. We got to have, like, a socially distant movie party.
Mm-hmm.
Highly recommend.
So, yeah, by the way, I'm moving home in, like, a month, finally.
Yeah,
so, eventually,
up.
Annie, we have to do one of these in real life where we actually watch a movie together.
We do. We should do it live or something.
Cool. So, God, what is even the fucking structure anymore? Quarantine has destroyed my sense of time and also routine.
Yeah, I mean, quarantine has kind of been the iconoclastic movement for time and social structures.
Okay. I mean, I guess, first of all, I guess we want to start with the review portion. Annie, how would you letter grade The Girl Who Leapt Through Time?
I mean, this gets an obvious A+ from me. The story is just so beautifully crafted, and the visuals are utterly stunning. There were so many shots where I just kind of wanted to pause for a second to look at stuff, but also wanted to keep going. This is a really beautifully constructed film in so many different ways. I also like how funny it is. I like how resonant it is with just being a teen and trying to get through life. So it's just kind of funny and full of heart and beautiful at the same time. So it gets an A+ from me. How about you, Jess?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's going to be an A+ for me as well. You know how much I love, you know, 2D animated features.
Yeah.
But not only that, is what stands out for me. And I actually didn't know what kind of to expect going into this, because I remember this very fondly. But also, it had been 10 years, and I had not seen this since before my transition.
Yeah.
And the reason I came to this film is because, actually, I'll say that for a second. I'll just say, like, I didn't know what to expect necessarily, but this is definitely an A+ for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll talk about why I decided to watch this film and why I roped you into it.
Yeah.
I was on Discord and we were talking about Hayao Miyazaki's films and Ghibli films in general. And one of the things that I talked about is this sense that we have a lot of media that focus on high schoolers. And in many ways, my personal theory is that, like, that's the last time that for a lot of us we had social mobility and freedom and weren't under the yoke of capitalism. So that's kind of like when everyone peaked in high school, it's not that we peaked. It's that society kicked us down a dirt hill. That aside, one thing that's kind of interesting is even with this kind of dearth of high school age characters and stories, they're often either sold to adults, in which case they are children, effectively, or they are sold to children, in which case they're effectively adults.
Yeah.
And there's not that much media that really actually captures the complexities and the kind of fluid uncertainty of actual adolescence.
Mm, that's really true. And
this film came to mind. And so it was just an inkling of what it was and the half-remembered memory. And I was just like, I really want to see this again because I am more familiar with Hosoda's other works that I've seen since, particularly Summer Wars, which, Annie, we have to do. It's incredible. Oh, my God.
Okay.
So when I thought of, you know, a film or a piece of media that actually feels adolescent but not in, like, a dismissive kind of way, this is the first thing that popped in my head. So that's why I kind of wanted to come to this one.
Oh, okay. That actually lines up really nicely with our, or I should say it dovetails with our episode on Beastars, which is kind of similarly exploring these really complicated themes, but this is doing something very different than Beastars was. And I liked it. It was less stressful than watching Beastars was.
Yeah, although, I don't know, the bike sequence.
Oh, yeah. Was a little... Okay, yeah, that part was stressful.
Yeah. Okay, so this is also always complicated with animated films, because it's much harder to talk about performances and these kind of technical aspects of it. Just because, you know, you don't have actors on screen necessarily. Now, the voice cast all did. We watched this using SyncPlay. But Annie, did you watch the dub or the sub?
I was watching the dub with subtitles.
Okay,
because I have old eyes.
So I watched this in Japanese. I watched this with subs. And wait, no. I watched this with the dub too. Never mind. My brain is not firing today. But, like, all the voices were fine, adequate, good, and also the IMDb only lists the Japanese voice cast, so I can't even comment specifically on that. But also there is the issue where animation is a very collaborative medium, and, like, unless you're, like, you know, Richard Williams. I was like, wait, which Williams is it? Unless, you know, you're, like, Richard Williams or you're Yuri Norstein and you're spending 20, 40 years working on a project all by yourself, it's really hard to say, like, oh, yeah, Mamoru Hosoda did that shot so fucking good. Because, like, there's this whole culture online in, like, the Sakuga and Genga communities where you track the careers of animators who are generally, like, very thankless. It's a very thankless job. And a lot of people, they say, like, you know, oh, here's a shot by this guy and here's a... Like, they track this kind of, like, it's very much industry, insider baseball, reading the trades kind of stuff. And I'm not in enough depth to really, like, comment on specific people in that. All I can say is that this is a really wonderfully animated film.
Yeah.
One thing I have really liked, and I need to find out who the actual character designer is, because I don't think it's Mamoru Hosoda himself. But, actually, is it on the IMDb? No, I don't think they list it like that.
IMDb's nope. Okay. Not that advanced.
No, they're not ready for it's not.
Details
it's...
like that.
Yeah, but I mean, also, like, the list of names is huge. I'm scrolling through the animation department right now, yeah. And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah. But I've always really loved whoever it is that works with Mamoru Hosoda on character design. Very much like how there's that signature Ghibli girl look.
Yeah.
There is a sense of proportion that I really find, I think pleasing is the wrong word, but it's very appealing, in that Hosoda's characters tend to be kind of lanky and awkward.
Mm. Yeah.
In a way that does not feel idealized. Because that's one thing I see in a lot of anime and a lot of art is this... And, like, hell, honestly, in live-action film as well, is that they are often idealized bodies. Is that's, you know, you get your Dawson casting where it's like, okay, cool, cool, look at all these high schoolers. They're all 27-year-old models. You know, it's like... And like even all the fat girls are like, oh, here's a fat, pretty white girl who's just, you know, it's
the CW is a terrible place.
Oh no, absolutely god awful place. And yet they have superheroes. Yep. So I guess superheroes discourse. Randy and Ubermensch. Moving away. There we go. I said Randy and Ubermensch. I don't have to say it for the rest of the podcast.
You got it out.
Yeah. So in a way. Even as an artist, this is something I struggle with, is this kind of dichotomy between realism and idealism, but also because everything is a constructed image. If I make someone awkward or ugly, that's a very deliberate choice.
Right.
And it's very easy for that to feel, you know, cruel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to say, like, this is not, like, a film where, like, there's a lot of, like, ugly or... like awkward looking characters. Like the main cast in particular, they are actually quite pretty. But it's still not, I think, in this sense idealized to the point where they feel unrelatable.
Yeah, I mean, I think the purpose of a lot of this film is to really kind of look deeper into the everyday and to see sort of like imperfections in everyday life as aesthetically beautiful. That's why you get a lot of these shots of overpasses and the sort of urban industrial landscape that's blended in with beautiful sunsets. And so I kind of see the way that they're putting the bodies of the characters together as really paralleling a lot of what they're doing with the landscape. It's imperfect. And yet,
and there's also a physicality to it that I really like.
Yeah.
This is something that I feel is okay. So let's talk about anime for a second, because there's a lot going on here. because again, like this did kind of stem up from the Ghibli conversation. Is there's this interesting trend in anime where, in the last 20 years especially, there has been much more of a market for respectable anime. You know, Hayao Miyazaki kind of crossed that barrier first. Princess Mononoke, I think, is the big one that kind of crossed there. And there is this idea of prestige anime, where when you go back to like the 90s and 80s in the OVA era, there's a lot more adaptations. And not even necessarily, because this is an adaptation. This is an adaptation. Well, this is a loose sequel to The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, which is a novel by Yasutaka Suisui. Sorry, Susui? I'm terrible. I'm so sorry if I've mispronounced that. Which has been adapted a bunch of times. 1972, 1983, 1983 again, 1985, 94, 97, 2002, 2006, this film, 2010, and 2016, and a manga. So, apparently a very important Japanese novel. But even so, there is this sense of... literature, I think, is probably, like, Annie, you can probably chime in on this a little bit. This idea of the separation of high art and low art and how that's kind of this tool of the fucking bourgeois. But this idea that, you know, if you're writing something respectable, it's got to be about sad people in New York. Or, like, there are these topics that are acceptable and, like, you can't have high art that's about superheroes, right? So we've seen these much bigger, more commercially successful quote-unquote high-art anime films in the last 20 years, where, I don't know, like, and I feel like this kind of rides the beginning of that wave, and I'm not sure where I was going specifically with this. You know, you need to take over for a bit, Annie.
So, I guess part of what I'm trying to figure out here is, like, you're seeing this as part of a wave of films that are maybe elevating the genre of anime. Because, like, anime has such a long, prestigious history in Japanese culture, extending far beyond the limits of film, back into painting. So it kind of has these fluxes in and out where it gains popularity and respectability. And then that waxes and wanes. So I guess part of what I like about this film is that blending that I was kind of talking about before, the blending of everyday objects, of the sort of like people on the ground, like the everyday person, with this very elevated visual style that takes their lives very seriously, that sees their lives as this staging area for, you know, high drama, but also humor. Like, he's not afraid to make jokes about pudding. I love the pudding jokes. That was great.
Yeah. So I think what's kind of interesting is when you look at Hosoda's career specifically, and I'll tell you a little bit about kind of where he comes from here, is like, he really got his start, like, his directorial debut was the Digimon movie.
Oh, really?
Or, like, the Digimon series. Like, yeah, no, he's very involved with Digimon. I'm not sure to what extent entirely, but, is one of his big credits. And you can actually see a lot of in, like, the kind of character design kind of influences from the Digimon movie, not necessarily the show as much.
Mm.
And I think he's also involved in the new one that they've done recently. So he comes very much from this kind of pop culture background. And I think, and color me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like I really like the word pulp to describe things as being pop culturally, pop culture, because like, we don't really, I think, have pulp genres in the same way anymore, but this idea that when something is made to be disposable and made to be mass market, I think that kind of describes not necessarily the aesthetics of what we've described as various pulp movements, but the kind of ethos and media environment that created them.
Mm, yeah, that's true.
And I think that's, and I like pulp versus high art, because I think high art is bullshit. And so, again, coming back to anime, one of the reasons I talk about this in relation to Miyazaki is Miyazaki is, I think, too high art to a degree. Like, I love his films, but I have issues with him as a filmmaker in that I feel like in a couple of ways he's very safe, and also because of his prestige and his dedication to this system of high art and low art and of these respectable prestige films, that his best work is Porco Rosso, because it is the most pulpy of all his works. And thus the most authentic and raw. Marco is the best character. We should do Porco Rosso as well. I'll try not to get into too much of a tangent there. And so this film, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, is very floaty, very poetic. It's a very, not necessarily even high art, but like this kind of like, there is definitely a thread that I don't know enough to comment on intelligently, but I've seen reference to, and I kind of get this vibe that it's part of the zeitgeist in Japan, where there is pop poetry.
Yeah.
Where there is this, like, you know, kind of aesthetic of floaty, ethereal beauty that is still yet in some way of its own poppy without being, like, the kind of prestigious, pretentious bullshit that we have with, you know, like, the American way of, like, ah, yes, you've read the latest Shmoopin poem.
Shmoopin. You know?
I don't fucking know. I was gonna making up names. Whatever. I wanted something that sounded German.
and you went with a Shmoopin. Okay. I gotcha.
It got the vibe across.
Yeah, it definitely gives you that high art snob sound, I think.
Yeah, well, you can't say, like, Schneider anymore, because, like, that makes me think of the Snyder Cut, and let's not get into that.
Oh, no.
But
no, the Snyder Cut is banned from this podcast. No.
Oh, no. Okay, but moving on. So, it feels like it's elevated to a tier, but it's also not, like, necessarily, I think, a timeless classic in some way. This is one thing. Oh, God, I just need to do a fucking Miyazaki episode. Because this conversation is really why I approached this film, is that in a way, like, Miyazaki, for example, is afraid of modernity in a way that, like, yes, it makes these timeless stories, but also adds this kind of layer of safety and abstraction, Whereas this is a modern film. It's not up to date to today. They still got flip phones and it's like pre-internet, but it is still a modern day film. Mm. In a weird way, it feels very 90s, actually.
Yeah, it does.
But, yeah. And so after this film, so we start with Digimon. We have this film in 2006, and Hosoda has done a feature film every 3 years since this film. Many of which I love very dearly. But the one that came after this in 2009 was a film called Summer Wars, which many people have called a remake of the Digimon movie, which I vehemently disagree with. Again, we will cover it. But it is this film, this actually very prescient film about social systems and like civil infrastructure being integrated into this great big Facebook-like entity, this virtual world. And then there's this hacking crisis, and there's this coming of age and slash romance story and family. And, like, you have this really touching stuff, but it's all set within this framework of, like, science fiction and speculative fiction and being, in some way or another, fantastical. And that feels much more pulpy than this. And so you've got kind of this spike and wave. And I don't know, I just find it interesting. Because, like, this is something I really rebel against personally, is this idea that pulp is set has less to say. When indeed I think the best filter is time. Because we look at the great works of the past, and like, I hate this because this gets very Western tradition and bias of history and writing out a lot of people who definitely had more to say and never got the chance to whatever, but y'all know the vibe with that. But you look at like fucking Shakespeare and that shit is all, you know, it's pulp, it's mass market consumption, and we kept it because it was resonant and it did have things to say. Where I think the worst thing you can do to your art is to have the pretension of creating high art. I think that absolutely kills anything mm-hmm. for me. I do not want to listen to, read, or watch anything that the creator sat down and says, today I shall create the great American novel. Oh. Fuck that guy.
Oh, shivers. Yeah, I mean,
and I think this
thing that you're chasing, this sort of difference between the fine and the realm of the popular, right? The realm of the people, which is a kind of messier space. It's a very modernist space that is often looked down upon, often projected upon in terms of, you know, social mores and stuff. I don't know that this film quite verges into the like the sort of same depths of the pulp, because pulp also carries with it these ideas about transgressing cultural mores and taboos and boundaries. So not just time, but things about, you know, like sex or relationships or national boundaries as well. It's kind of, I think that's why I like this film so much, is because it's sort of in between these two boundaries, and it really points to the constructedness of both, and I like that immensely. I also just like how down to earth it is, if that makes sense. Like, I get the feeling that a lot of the shots from this came from somebody standing outside and seeing something around them, and they're like, damn, that's beautiful. I feel like that belongs in here. And I really like that. I think it gives this film a kind of grounding in the sphere of the everyday that maybe I haven't seen in some of the other animes that we've taken a look at.
So what you're saying is, and I thought of the phrase, and I really wanted to share this with you, Annie, that it's kind of floating at a Lagrange point between pulp and high art.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say that.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to say Lagrange point. It's a cool concept that I keep forgetting the name of, and I remembered it, so I wanted to get there. One thing, actually, I want to talk about the backgrounds for a second here, because also with this prestige that comes, you get artists like Makoto Shinkai who have come out with these like really beautiful, vivid skyscapes that are a part of his work. Or, you know, so like something like Your Name, and you've got these like big fisheye lenses with these clear, big open skies and these dramatic events happening. But what I see in this reminds me, because this is not like a super urban setting. I don't know what prefecture or whatever part of Japan this is set in, but this is not like Tokyo or Shibuya, this is very much a suburban kind of setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet, one thing I see when I look at the skyscapes, especially like you look at the one by the highway or with the, what is it, like a reservoir or something where the kids are playing?
Yeah, it's not like a natural
thing. But the sky there reminds me very much of my childhood when, you know, I would have a long commute to and from school and, you know, I'd be on like the elevated highway in Bangkok and I would see, you know, God beams. I would see a sunset. I would see clouds. And there would be like this kind of dirty beauty to the sky yeah. in this urban landscape.
Yeah.
And in a way, it feels kind of urban, even though it really isn't, which is interesting to me, I guess I should say.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the settings are part of this sort of urban sprawl, right? Because Tokyo isn't just the city center. It's all of the stuff around it. There's like 9 cities within Tokyo, basically. So I could kind of see it being exactly what you describe as a suburb. And that's where you kind of get that sprawl. That's where you sort of get that. I don't know. We don't really get urban decay from this. We just get a lot of like concrete structures and stuff. The sort of like gray walls that are transformed by these backgrounds that they're set against. So, yeah, he sort of sees beauty in these spaces that I think are probably overlooked.
Yeah. There's also one thing that I really like about this is there is a sense of quietness to this film. And that's something that I don't think we necessarily get a lot of in our lives these days.
No.
But it's not like this kind of wanky, oh, we sit in the fields and listen to the cicadas kind of quiet. Is there is a pace to life, and this is something that I think is kind of important for what this film is, because you've got this kind of like rising tension with, you know, Makoto has her life as it is. She has this summer and she really likes where life is right now. Yep. And there is this equilibrium that is slowly falling apart, and she's trying to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at the stillness, like, you know, the classrooms and so on, it's not a stillness where things are dead quiet, but it's a stillness where, you know, you're, like, sitting at your desk and everyone's settling in. There's this sense of routine
mm-hmm.
and this sense of not necessarily silence, but of quiet where noise is fading into the background.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great way to describe it.
So like if I were to talk about this from like a sound engineering, this is not like a recording studio. This is like recording, like, you know, 30 feet away from a highway.
I think silence, you know, can be uncomfortable. And with this, I like that you're describing it as quiet instead, because that really is what it is. It's the sort of beats in between sound, the sort of, the interstitial space between when action happens and when things just kind of slow down for a bit. I don't know if you felt this way, but I found this film extremely relaxing to watch in parts as a result of that sort of sound engineering. And then it makes your heart race in the moments where the sound and the score itself are sort of building towards a crescendo.
Yeah, that's one thing I really liked. And this is actually something that marks this, I think, very good as a time travel movie because it plays with time in a way. First of all, I think it's already a great time travel movie just based on like plot analysis and everything, but we can get to that later. But one thing is this idea that there's this kind of ludonarrative synergy, I should call it. And I say ludonarrative like this is a fucking video game. It's a narrative conceit, I guess would be the thing. Where Makoto is basically putting her problems aside and trying to delay the outcomes and running away from her problems. Mm-hmm. That's what she's doing. But that is also what we receive, is even though we understand the tension, we understand, no, this will come back to haunt you, you're just running away from your problems, it doesn't work like this. When she does a time jump and she starts doing new stuff, we get to breathe because the problems are pushed later into the film. So, you know, she's leaping through time, but we are leaping through, I guess, filmic time at the same time. So let's talk about Makoto, because like we've spent a lot of time already and we haven't even really discussed the characters of plot in any kind of detail, which I mean, is
there's
fun.
Just like, lots to say. I mean, this was a really enjoyable film to watch, to just like sit down and watch. And I say that as somebody who really needed moments of stillness and something to enjoy, to kind of savor in this moment. So yeah, why not? We should talk about Makoto.
You're welcome. Okay. There's a triad of main characters, and like I'm hoping folk have watched this film, and like you're not just sitting through it as well, because it is something to really enjoy.
I hope people check it out.
We're here.
Yeah.
So you have Makoto, Chiaki, and Kosuke, mm-hmm. or is it Kosuke? Kosuke. Okay. And you've got this kind of triad, and one thing that I really like, first of all, that is the other thing that I was kind of nervous about, is I'm always nervous about approaching films that were dear to me before transition. Because the way that I relate to them can and does fundamentally change. I can't think of anything specific off the top of my head, but there's quite a few ones where it's just like, okay, this is like really queerphobic, or it's like, wow, this guy, like, you know, you grow up as a boy and you're like, oh, this guy's so cool, he gets all the ladies, and now I come back to it as a girl, it's just like, this guy's a misogynist asshole, fuck this guy. So in a way I was kind of braced for this, but like I was kind of braced for like either I'm going, like maybe it's just gonna make me cry and be nostalgic, but Makoto is, I think, still an incredibly relatable and wonderful character, in that she's just trying to get by. And like, in many ways, she's very immature, but not in a way that I think isolates. And this is what I mean when I say that this film is messy and teenage in a way that many films aren't. There is no, in this film, I mean, I guess technically if you want to break down the plot points into like text, like if you did like a Wikipedia summary of this, there's a little bit of, you know, the liar revealed or the deliberate miscommunication.
Yeah,
going on.
There is.
But it does not feel like the liar revealed. Nothing feels forced in this film. Nothing's just like, why don't you guys fucking talk to each other? It's like, no, there's it's earned in this way that these are complicated feelings. And the biggest thing, and I think this is like a beautiful irony, is that the protagonist of this time travel movie is trying to hold stasis.
Yep. Yeah. She really is.
Because this is a summer, and this is actually, honestly, probably something I related to the first time I saw this. And, you know, it's hard because all the depression holes in my memory and so on, because she is going through this wonderful, wonderful summer. She has her two best friends. They play baseball. She's got a future coming up where she needs to decide, like, you know, is she going into whichever college course? And, like, she has to make some very heavy and big decisions. And as the summer is ending, this is a time that she wants to hold on to. And I spent a lot of my childhood, I moved to Thailand when I was 5 years old. Or 4 and a half, I guess. And I spent a long fucking time, years and years, wishing to go back to something. Because that was a time before the language barrier, before the climate, before the trauma of moving as a young child. And so in my mind, and like, I know it wasn't idealized, but like, I was fucking five. So, you know, this idea of going back to my childhood and going back to before the complication and the trouble and the fear and the weight. That was something that was resonant, has been resonant for me for my entire life. And I get the feeling that Makoto is in that moment. And no, it's not a perfect moment. It's fucking high school. It's a nightmare. But right now, that is a moment that is peaceful, that is comfortable, that is safe. And in many literal ways and in many emotional spaces, she's tried to, like, she's not afraid of a relationship with Chiaki. You know, she does like him. And the issue is that it is this dynamic of change. It is this escalation to romance. It is not the thing that she is afraid of. What she's afraid of, and at least this is my read, is that this is the end of summer. That if she accepts this, that this is time moving on, and that this beautiful moment that seems like a respite. I don't know, maybe this is just me projecting, but I feel like there's some stress before and after in her life. That it's gone. And then it's this symbology. And in that way, I find that so messy and realistic, or I guess relatable, versus a lot of these kinds of plots where it's just like, no, I don't want a boyfriend. What if my best friend's mad because she likes him? And like, you know, there's if, I mean, it's a film, it's a script, it's anime, it is artifice. It is nothing but artifice, but there is no sensation of artifice to this film.
I really like the way that you just described it as this kind of transitory moment for her, where she wants to stay in a state of stasis to kind of like give herself a cushion. She doesn't want to choose her college major. She doesn't want to make big life decisions. She just wants this. And I kind of like that. It reminds me a lot of the joke about the pudding, because pudding is comfort food. It's that thing that you reach for when you're a kid, when you just really want to enjoy something. And I really see that a lot in her. And I kind of grabbed onto her own hesitation to get involved in relationships. Just because it is about change, it is about her world altering. And I love the idea of this being about seasonal change and, you know, potentially moving forward into these weird, not even adulthood, but like in these weirder, complicated relationships that she doesn't know what to do with yet. I like that. And I like the messiness of it, as you said too. She's also just adorable and gangly and hilarious at times, but also has such a deep love and care for her friends. And yet at the same time hasn't fully figured out the implications of her actions. So it's just kind of a great moment.
First of all, I love... from now on, I'm just going to refer to this as your pudding truther vibes.
Pudding truthers.
Yeah. It's really funny because I think, had I encountered this film today, this is, I guess, my queer politics showing.
Would you not have noticed the
pudding? I'm just like, God. No, let me finish. God. No, but, like, I think if I had encountered this film today, I'd be much more like, aw, she's straight. You know? But, like, genuinely, like, there's a lot of vibes. Like, it's really interesting because I think that's also part of, like, that kind of, like, pulpiness that this kind of elevates away from is this idea of using characteristics as shortcuts.
Yeah.
Where, you know, she's into baseball, she doesn't want to go out with boys necessarily, she's very athletic. There's a lot of these, like...
She's a tomboy.
She's tomboyish.
Yeah.
And where I feel like in something that wasn't as subtle or as deft as this, that'd be like, oh, no, these are all, like, the lesbian signifiers.
Yeah.
But So one thing about the time travel that I kind of don't like, is that it's a little bit of a zero-sum game.
Okay.
It's like, you know, and it's a little bit of predetermination, it's like, oh, you know, there's gonna be a fire in home ec.
Right.
If you don't do it, someone else is gonna get it. And there's this kind of spiral of despair. And part of it is like, yeah, you can't avoid the consequences of your action. It's just, I think, a little bit too literal for my taste.
Okay. Oh, one of the things that I was wondering if we could talk about was, I think it's Chiaki, who, like, the taller guy with the dark hair, who has this kind of...
The dark hair is Kosuke.
Kosuke. Who kind of has this will-they-or-won't-they relationship with that super shy girl who keeps coming up to him and being embarrassed by her friends.
I love that. Kosuke is such... I love him. He's kind of a lunk, but he's this really, like, solid character.
Yeah.
You know, very supportive, very kind of blunt, and...
Yeah, he's got that big Taurus energy.
Oh, no, don't bring astrology. No.
It's already happened, Jess. It's too late.
Ah, fuck. Okay. Cool.
So he's strong and stable.
So you were talking about Kosuke.
Yeah.
What about Kosuke?
I don't know. I was just talking about this, like, funny little relationship that he has with this young woman where it's very will they or won't they. And there are also a lot of questions about, like, does he actually know that she exists?
So what I find actually, I really find this charming, is in part of Makoto's journey to, like, avoid consequences and try and keep stasis, she tries to set him up with her.
Yeah.
And one thing I really like is that it doesn't fucking work.
Yep.
Until she kind of comes to the realization in the maturation to say, you know what, just let them have at it. And just fucking chill. Because you can't make people like each other. You can't...
Yeah.
Like, and this is something, like, I very much relate to in queer spaces, is there's what a lot of... Like, in trans spaces especially, is what's called the prime directive. I don't think that's the formal name. That's what I call it. Is you can't tell someone they're trans. Like, they can show all the signs, but you can't assign them that label.
Yeah.
They can't... What you can do is live as an example.
Yeah.
And show them that it is safe and that you are welcoming and supportive. And eventually, maybe, hey, they come out. Or maybe, hey, they don't. Maybe they're not even queer. But this idea of being like, yo, that's some egg shit, bro.
Mm-hmm.
You ever think about wearing a skirt? Like, that's kind of rude. It's kind of... And trying to force it can actually push people back in the closet. Which is ironic for me to say, because I actually did have to get fucking prime directive. Just like, hey, Jess, if you were next, I wouldn't be surprised. And I'd be like, oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
But I got trauma. I got issues. And that's more specific to me. It's not a good general practice to have.
Yeah.
But they're adorable. And I also really, really like the best friends. They're funny as hell.
Oh, they're so hilarious. No. I don't know what they're doing.
But actually, talking about, I think it's either Yuri or Kaho. I don't remember who exactly. I'm terrible with names, especially for bit characters. But the girl that Kosuke ends up with, in the timeline where they die,
mm-hmm.
It's actually a really beautiful thing. Not their death. No, because that's, like, fucking traumatic as shit.
Yeah, that was sad.
But... This is what I really respect, and, like, Kosuke is not a real person, like, but, like, I would love to be his friend, because this whole thing is just, like, it's not about that she's cute or that he wants to get into her pants, it's just that she hurt herself, and he wants to make sure she's okay.
Yeah.
There's that very solid supporting energy, and that's something that's very admirable.
Yeah.
Like, I would want to be Kosuke's friend. Oh, actually... No, that's a really good thing about this. A broad topic we can kind of come into is, like, in many ways, some of the more important threads of this film are romantic.
Yeah, they are. Very much so.
But they are chaste without being Puritan.
Yeah.
which is something I like, because that's one issue that is, like, here's the thing, like, I defend pulp, and I will, you know, stand against the fucking bourgeois museum motherfuckers. At the same time, though, I will concede the single ground is that anime has a real sexualizing children problem.
Yep. Yep.
And, like, I'm just really glad to dodge that. And actually, like, I'll speak about my own relationships for a little bit, because this is kind of an interesting parallel. Once I got to college, I got pretty fucking horny, because I was a late bloomer, and also, I didn't socially bloom until then. But when I was in, you know, middle school and high school, I had, like, one relationship, really. And it was awkward, and it was cute. But there were a couple of things. Is like, I didn't have much social, much mobile, like, actual locomotion. Like, I didn't have a car. I couldn't get into town by myself very easily. So, like, there mostly it was time spent actually in school. And, like, you know, the occasional movie or something. I think the most we ever did was hold hands. And that feels authentic to this film.
Yeah.
Where there's this idea of, like, I like you. I like being around you. And, yeah, there's this knowledge and this understanding of these kind of escalations and complications that we could go into, but it's not part of the design, and it's not part of what we're seeing right now.
Yeah.
And since then, I have become the kind of bitch that sleeps with someone on the first date and then just moves in with people. And, like, there's something, like, I don't want to fetishize innocence in childhood.
Yeah.
But there is something sweet there.
Oh yeah, totally.
To be clear, for reference, you do not need to talk about your fucking sexual history in this one. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, I'm fine with that. I just kind of like how use the word authentic. I think these characters are very sincere, and that's also something that I really enjoyed. Like, yeah, there's definitely high school, you know, pettiness and ridiculousness in this. But the characters are very, they're very grounded, they're very sincere people, complete with their flaws and all, and I like the way that the romances kind of took that into account, because you're talking about them being chaste and everything, and I was just kind of like, you know, it feels, a lot of the relationships feel like friendships to me that could potentially turn into something else down the way, and I just think that's kind of cute, so yeah.
It is, and I mean, like, that's personal fucking rant time. Is like, that's how I think more relationships should be. I think I've talked to you about this. Okay, I don't think I've ever talked about this on the podcast, so I think I might as well, but I don't believe in dating.
Yeah, we have talked about this. Not on the podcast, though.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, pretend like you haven't and ask me about that, so
Jess,
it's like
engaged. I heard you have this theory about how dating sucks and it doesn't make any sense. Could you please elaborate?
All right, you didn't have to lay it on so fucking thick. Jesus. So here's my kind of thing. Is I don't believe in dating. I don't date, quote unquote. I have relationships, absolutely. But I don't, I try where I can not to make the distinction between romantic and platonic relationships, because I think that division is something that causes a lot of grief in this world. Especially for fucking cishet white boys. Let's be real there. You have this idea that we take everyone and we sort them into, you know, the fucks and the fucknots, essentially. You put them in two piles. And you treat them, people, very differently based on that. And, like, even at its most benign, at this idea of, like, oh, well, you know, when my girlfriend comes over, or, like, when I'm trying to impress this chick, like, I stand up straighter, and I clean my room, and I wear a tie. It's like, even if it's aspirational, like, this is the person I could be more often, it's still, on some level, manipulative or deceptive and dehumanizing. And I say this, and because this is actually something that's really factored into my life in very big ways, because that's how I got married. Because my husband, Locke, which, trans shit, was presenting as a girl at the time. I had not cracked yet at the time. But he invited me to a motocross rally. And I was like, well, he's the young girl at the office. I don't want to be a creep. And he is very cute and I would definitely smash. So I'm going to, I shouldn't do this. And I realized in that moment, it's like, I'm being a really shitty friend. If anyone else at the office had been like, hey, you want to go to motocross? I'd be there with a beer helmet on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, this idea of seeking people specifically to fill a romantic vibe is like, it's something I don't have much experience with. And I think it's something that kind of hurts our collective soul as a society.
Oh, yeah.
In that, like, especially with this expectation, especially with, like, cishet couples, is like, you know, you're not, for men especially, like, you know, you can't be close, you can't be open, you can't be vulnerable. You know, you have to save all your emotional needs for one person. And that's why, you know, you get so many fucked up white boys who want, like, a mother, therapist, nurse, mother whore.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, because, like, that's how all my relationships have been since college, pretty much, is this idea of being friends with someone and allowing that to grow and to bloom. And it is complicated and it is a big deal. This is not to say that I treat these things lightly, that I'm inconsiderate of people's feelings or so on, but it's kind of more a broad philosophical stance I hold that I try to live where I can, but, like, you know, with mind to practicalities. And one thing I kind of see, and to actually bring this back to the film for a second.
Yeah.
Because that was just like a personal rant. This is just Jess's soapbox.
Yeah.
But I see that in Chiaki a little bit, because what I see is they are friends and that they enjoy spending time together. And he wants to escalate things.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting to me is how Makoto rejects that, at least initially. Eventually she comes around to it and it's complicated and it's kind of one of the cruxes of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But initially it's like, hey, do you want to go out sometime? And that, to Makoto, is the worst thing anyone could say to her.
Yep.
Because it is a declaration of change. It is a genie you cannot put back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. Even though she has time travel powers, and she damn well tries, she, like, this idea that things change, that I'm trying to think of how to phrase this exactly, but, and I think this is part of, like, this is another, like, personal peeve that relates to that, is, like, I really hate when people say that they have a crush. Not that they have a crush on someone. Like, I have crushes on plenty of people. I think it's lovely to have crushes. I think calling someone your crush is possessive.
Yeah.
And harmful.
Yep.
Because in a way, you create a version of them in your head that you own, and people are just like, my crush is going on a date. Fuck you. You didn't ask them out.
Yeah.
They don't belong to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Stop being entitled to other people. Like, shoot your shot or get off the pot. And so,
yeah. Yeah.
When he makes this, there's this idea that asking someone out or making that kind of escalation is the worst thing ever because it's such a huge risk. Because I think when she's afraid of, hey, do you want to go out sometime? It's not a question of she's being afraid of going out with him. I think she very much wants to. But what I see is she looks at that as the end of the friendship because either it moves on to the relationship, which for a lot of people is fundamentally different to a friendship. And I think that's fucked up.
Yeah, that's very
Or it doesn't work out, and that is the end of things. Because even if, like, you know, even if, like, let's look at the use cases. Like, okay, she says yes, they go out, and they live happily ever after. Cool, whatever. But it's still the end of a friendship. It's the end of the summer. They go out, and then they break up later, and now they're no longer friends because breakups are hard. Sure. But the other use case is if she says no. And if she says no, then, like, for me personally, I don't think that's too big of a deal. Like, this is kind of where my philosophy kind of dovetails with this, is, like, it shouldn't be a big deal. But we don't deal well with rejection, men or women, boys or girls, in society.
Yeah.
Because what that becomes then is it's no longer a friendship. It is a aborted relationship.
Yes. Yeah.
And
so giving that's, any answer,
I guess, a very human tragedy.
Is really a problem.
Like,
yeah.
I say this like I'm above all this. Like, I'm like, I don't date. I'm above such petty mortal concerns. But no, I do relate to it. And this is also more of a typical modus for most people. And it's very... I really like their relationship in a lot of ways because there's a lot of subtlety going on. In particular, after he asked her the first time, there's a lot of it that I don't think is necessarily in the text, quote-unquote. Like, it's not in the script, it's not in the written lines. But there's this definite vibe that Chiaki has picked up that she's avoiding him.
Right, yeah.
It's something that's unspoken. It's something that's in the absence between words. And, like, that's a real social dynamic. And it's subtle, and it's kind of hurts.
Yep.
But, like, that's something I think a lot of us have gone through.
Oh, yeah.
I think, for my closing thought, I'll just call this my closing thoughts here. Mm-hmm. That what is presented is very much a story of adolescence and of change and of growing up.
Yeah.
It is coming out of summer into a world that, by necessity and inexorability, will change.
Yeah.
And that our small comforts, our pleasant and comfortable existence, is subject to turbulence.
Yep.
And it is the sense of clinging to that. And that is, I think, what I love about this, is it is very much a teenage story. And I don't have a lot of those in my life. I didn't have a very typical childhood. I don't have a lot of memories from my childhood or my adolescence.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I'm going through a new one now, but in many ways, it will never be the same thing because I have responsibilities, I have regrets, I have a lot more baggage than your typical teenager.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, I think this is kind of a proxy for me. This is something that I get to experience, that I get to enjoy, because it is a brief glimpse, I guess, into summer.
Yeah.
And I haven't had a summer in a long time. I have not had a vacation, I think, really. Okay, I had one in January, but that was, you know, to meet my wife, and that was part of a big life change. But, like, I have not had that stillness in my life.
Yeah.
Since forever. Like, over a decade. And that is something that I find very precious in this film. How about you, Annie?
I really like... People use the term ephemerality a lot at these moments that sort of, like, come and go and a lot of times are overlooked. I like that this director wants us to look at those things and to notice the passage of time through all these different ways, whether that be through visual references to clocks or squadrons of men who are drilling, or references to, you know, transitional periods between summer and fall. I like that he wants us to notice. I like the stillness and the characters in this. This movie felt like a very comfortable and comforting space for me to be in for a little while. And that's part of what made watching it so lovely. So, to give it another plug, if you can find this, go watch it.
All right. This has been The Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I've been your host, Jess Whitmore. You guys can find me on Twitter at JessicaOnMain. Annie, where can people find you?
People can always come and find me on Twitter at AnnieProducer. And sometimes I'm on the Discord. I kind of lurk around. Sorry if I'm not on as often as I want to be. I'm dissertating. But come visit anyway. Sometimes I like people's posts on the down low.
Mm-hmm. You're very sneaky. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can also find... We have a link to the Discord in the show notes. And beyond that, our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factibus. Find a link to their EP of the same name in the show notes, by my friend Tommy. Love that boy. And yeah, you guys can follow us on Twitter at Movie Morgue Cast, even though I am a terrible social media manager. I got brain problems, okay? Just give me some slack. Or on Facebook at Movie Morgue Cast. Just search for Movie Morgue Podcast. if you want to support us, keep us in, you know, celluloid and server space, we have a... I have a Patreon.
Yeah.
It's for the fucking thing. You know how it is. At patreon.com/JessicaOnMain.
We're going to have some bonus episodes coming out for you in the next month or two. We didn't get to make as many as we wanted just because global pandemic, dissertation, all kinds of crazy stuff has happened. But keep an eye on our Simplecast account. You will be able to see some of them popping up for you in the next few weeks.
Yeah. Thank you all. We love you. Take care of yourselves. Be kind. Bye-bye.